I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. A federal program that's supposed to focus on violent offenders and drug runners has led to the deportation of undocumented immigrants who committed no crime. In fact, more than 40% of the immigrants deported from Maryland in the federal sweep have no prior criminal record. John Fritzy of the Baltimore Sun joins us to talk about his story on the Secure Communities program and the response to it. Also today, the minimum wage debate in Annapolis, where the death of businessman Willard Hackerman leaves plans for a new arena in downtown Baltimore. And it's Valentine's Day, dinner and a movie, maybe a concert or an unconventional romance novel. The Midday Weekly Review begins after the news from NPR. Hey, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Midday Weekly Review. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks for joining us. Contractor Willard Hackerman left his imprint all over Baltimore. His Whiting Turner Company built the stadium where the Ravens play, Harbor Place, the National Aquarium, the new University of Baltimore Law School, and countless other buildings in Maryland and around the country. When he died at 95 this week, he left on the drawing board ambitious plans for a new downtown arena, something he was willing to build with his own millions. We'll talk about the Hackerman legacy with WYPR news analyst Fraser Smith and with Ryan Sharrow of the Baltimore Business Journal. Also today, a look at a federal program that focuses on undocumented immigrants who are violent offenders or people caught up in the drug trade. The reporting of John Fritzy in the Baltimore Sun, however, reveals that this program has led to the deportation of a disproportionate number of undocumented immigrants who committed no crimes. In fact, more than 40% of the immigrants deported from Maryland in this sweeping federal program had no prior criminal record. John Fritzy joins us in a few minutes to talk about his story on the Secure Communities program and the response to it by, among others, Governor O'Malley. And still later in today's show, it's Valentine's Day, Valentine's weekend, you might say. Paula Gallagher of the Baltimore County Library offers some reading suggestions, what she calls unconventional love stories, not your storybook romances. Henry Hong and John Shields have some recipes for the romantics who want to cook the food of love this weekend. And if you're interested in a concert, we'll tell you about one this weekend in Westminster featuring the funk soul sounds of Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds. What time did you get up? Work tonight, baby. I think I would know if you were. Yeah, sounds good. We'll hear a little bit more of that later on in the show. We start the weekly review in Annapolis. A bill to raise the minimum wage in Maryland got its first public hearing this week in the House Economic Affairs Committee. WYPR's Statehouse reporter Christopher Connolly was there, and he joins me now. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot. Happy to be here.
Hey, describe that scene for you with us, would you? What did it look like down there?
I mean, this was, it was big, big turnout. I mean, the kind of turnout you don't really see for committee hearings, generally speaking. Advocates for raising the wage turned out by the dozens. Same, too, for people who were against raising the wage. So many people showed up that they had to set up an overflow room. No, not everybody could fit into the committee chamber. All told, something like 100 people testified. Wow. One of them, Governor O'Malley, and then also at least three candidates who were trying to replace him as governor. A few other notables. It went on for something like 4 hours, all told.
So what's in this bill, Chris? What is actually being proposed?
So there's actually a few bills that they were talking about, a few bills in the House. The one that advocates seem to be rallying around is the one that was introduced by O'Malley. It calls for three things. It says raise the minimum wage to $10.10, then it'll do that in steps by 2016. After that, they want to peg it to inflation, so basically it won't lose value as the cost of living goes up. And then the last bit is to raise the separate server wage that tipped employees get. Aisha Braveboy, a delegate from Prince George's, she has introduced a nearly identical bill, and she's actually done that for the last couple of years. There's another bill that would try to raise it to $12 an hour, sort of getting it closer to a living wage. On the other side, there's a Republican bill that would give counties the authority to raise minimum wage, basically saying, you know, cost of living isn't the same all over Maryland. It varies by county. And so let counties decide what the right wage is.
Governor O'Malley, of course, supporting the 10 an hour by 2016, which is also the proposal at the federal level that President Obama and the Democrats have proposed. But politically speaking, here in Maryland, in the legislature, Chris Connolly, how likely are any of these to pass this session?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I was to put my bet on just one to pass, it would be the one that the governor has backed, that 10-10 an hour. You know, he's put all of his weight behind it. He's been out sort of stumping for it. And it's also got a large coalition behind it. You know, everybody from workers and business owners, religious leaders and politicians that are backing it. There is and there seems to be a critical mass of Democrats, you know, that are interested in it, but the biggest stumbling block will be Senate President Mike Miller. He's very powerful. He is in charge of the Senate. And he says he thinks $10 is too high. He's also expressed some support for the idea that counties should set their own wages, you know, basically saying living in Baltimore City costs a lot more than living on the Eastern Shore or in Western Maryland, so maybe we don't want a single unified rate, or that $10 is just too much for some of those places.
And at that big hearing, Chris, the arguments for and against, can you break it down for us a little bit? I mean, we've heard a lot of these arguments, but go right ahead.
Yeah, I mean, not a whole lot of new arguments, really. You know, basically, proponents are saying two things. They say it's the right thing to do. They say Maryland has the highest median income in the country. But there are 20 states with a higher minimum wage. You know, we just have the base federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, and they say that's not something you can live on. They also say it's good for the economy. You know, one study says that it would put hundreds of millions of dollars into the pockets of low-income people, low-wage workers, and that research shows that you put money into working people's pockets, and they turn around and they spend that money on new products and services. So, you know, it goes back out into the economy, and will have a sort of small but measurable impact. They cite a body of economics research that says there are really pretty minimal downsides and a lot of upsides to it. Opponents, of course, say, what if that math is wrong? They have their own economists who say it kills jobs, it'll make Maryland less competitive, it could even lead to people dropping out of, you know, high school or college to get these now higher-wage jobs if we raise $10 an hour. And then, you know, a large part of this debate is about who these low-wage workers are. So opponents say, you know, there are very few people who actually make minimum wage in Maryland, and they say these people are mostly teenagers making the wage. These are entry jobs that you work your way up from, you know, you get better wages as you get older, and, you know, so why should we change that? But proponents say, you know, if you expand it and look at low-wage jobs, you know, jobs anywhere from that $7.25, $8 an hour, $9 an hour, $10 an hour, you end up with hundreds of thousands of people, and you end up with a lot of them who are parents, who are raising kids who just can't make it, and who end up turning to government assistance to supplement their income. And they say, you know, now we're subsidizing low-wage jobs from fast food chains and box stores. So everybody has their research. Everybody cites their numbers. And we'll see where it goes.
Yep. It'll be interesting to see how this shakes out between Governor O'Malley and Senate President Miller in particular. And how long do you think it'll be before we see a floor vote, either in the Senate or the House?
Well, the next step is the Senate's going to have the Senate Finance Committee will take up the Senate version of this bill. They were going to do it yesterday, but the legislature got shut down. There was a snowstorm. So that's going to happen on Monday now. And then, you know, the House Economics Committee will make their ruling favorable or unfavorable, and it'll make it away. But it's going to be a while before we really see anything final and conclusive on this. So it's something we'll have to keep watching.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Chris Connolly for WYPR covers the State House for the station, joining us here on the Midday Weekly Review. Interesting story at MarylandReporter.com this week concerning the Maryland Board of Elections. Recall that the state elections administrator Linda Lamone made a controversial ruling about fundraising by candidates for governor and lieutenant governor during the 90-day General Assembly session. Lamone ruled that under state law, Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown could not solicit campaign contributions during the session, but that his running mate, Howard County Executive Ken Ullman, could. As a result, supporters of Attorney General Douglas Gansler, one of Lieutenant Governor Brown's Democratic rivals, are suing Lamone, arguing that her ruling gave an unfair advantage to his opponent in the June primary. This has led to some questions about Linda Lamone's authority. Glynis Kazanjian had the story for MarylandReporter.com and joins us now. Glynis, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. So didn't Linda Lamone have the authority to make this ruling? I mean, it would have been pretty awkward for the Attorney General to make it, right?
Dan, as I understand it, Linda Lamone has the authority to prepare and summarize campaign finance law, which she has done in the past with advice from the Attorney General's office. But in this case, she asked the Attorney General's office to recuse themselves, and the fundraising guidelines were issued without any legal guidance.
So this has raised some concerns among board members, right, at the Elections Board.
Yeah, the board members, the board is going to meet on February the 27th, and they are going to make a motion to vote on reducing some of her authority, basically putting protections in place that she can, so she cannot issue a ruling like this again without their knowledge or consent.
So they must have been taking some heat over this. Of course, there is a lawsuit filed, but it's pretty controversial considering that the primary isn't that far off. It's just in June this year instead of September.
The lawsuit may actually be dismissed according to its possibility it could be dismissed because Linda Lamone reversed these controversial fundraising guidelines on January the 29th. And I don't know how widely reported that's been. I did the story announcing the reversal, and her new rulings make it practically impossible for Allman to raise money during session. And as far as we can tell, Allman is not raising any money. There's no indication that they're accepting donations on their campaign website. So Mr. Clements, who's involved with the lawsuit against Lamone, Brown, and Allman, said one of the possibilities is potentially it could be dismissed.
Well, that's news to me, the January 29th ruling. I didn't realize that. And Daniel Clements, that you referred to as the attorney who brought this suit against Lamone and others.
Yes.
Well, that's...
I know, it hasn't really been widely reported.
No.
I'm not sure why, but we got the story, and we reported it right away.
Right, because we were assuming that this unfair advantage was in place, but apparently she's reversed herself. Well, thank you for pointing that out to us. I also want to mention that, Glynis, you had another story this week at MarylandReporter.com, a story about Governor O'Malley's views on the Maryland school assessment tests in Common Core.
Yes, the governor's office said yesterday that they will not support legislation at this point to prevent the MSA test from going forward. So without the governor's signature, even if the bill gets passed in the state legislature, it won't go anywhere. And right now they just think that there's value to the standardized tests, even though they're based on pretty much outdated curriculum. But he's not going to support it, so it looks like it's going to happen.
So one more year for the MSA before the Common Core standards kick in. Glynis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan.
Yep. Glynis Kazanjian from MarylandReporter.com. You can find both those stories we mentioned here, the one involving the election board and one involving Common Core and Governor O'Malley's ruling on the MSA at the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. We're going to take our first break here. Still ahead, reflections on the life of the builder and philanthropist Willard Hackeman and a look at a plan he left on the drawing board. Fraser Smith joins us, along with Ryan Sharrow of the Baltimore Business Journal. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday and the Weekly Review. Dan Roderick's here. A federal program that's supposed to focus on violent offenders and drug runners has led to the deportation of undocumented immigrants who committed no crime. In fact, more than 40% of the immigrants deported from Maryland in the federal sweep had no prior criminal record. John Fritzy ran the numbers of the Secure Communities Program in Maryland and did the reporting on this story. He joins us now. Welcome back to Midday, John.
Hey, Dan.
What's been the response to your story? Is anyone concerned that this program is sweeping up and deporting people who were, you know, not the intended targets?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the advocates are concerned about that. There's been a fair bit of response. I think The most significant was a letter that Governor O'Malley wrote to the Department of Homeland Security on Tuesday, raising questions about the program and seeking some more information to try to get at what exactly is going on here. You know, the Obama administration has frequently said that their target, both for this program and their immigration policy at large, is dangerous criminals. And so when you look at this data and you see that the majority of people deported under secure communities have no felony violations, and about, as you said, about 40% of them have no criminal convictions at all, it does raise questions about what exactly is going on here in states like Maryland and a few other states where the numbers are a lot different than what's happening in the rest of the nation.
Let's talk about the background just a little bit, John. This program has been in place since 2008, 2009, and it's seen in some jurisdictions, not in others in Maryland.
In Maryland, it's now statewide. The last two jurisdictions to come on board were Baltimore and Montgomery County 2 years ago. That's initially what got me interested in this story, was just to look at, well, where are things in Baltimore 2 years after secure communities came in? You know, I met with a fair amount of criticism at the time, including from Mayor Rawlings Blake, some other local leaders in the state. It's essentially an automated process. When you get arrested, when anybody gets arrested in the state and your fingerprints are taken, they now pretty much instantly go to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and they will check to see if you're in the country illegally or not. And if you're here illegally, they will ask the local jail to hold that arrestee so that they can come pick them up and proceed with an immigration deportation hearing. And so it's pretty much automated, and it's statewide now.
So is there a bit of a Trojan horse here? The original intent was to go after violent offenders and people who are involved in the drug trade, and then we end up making motor vehicle stops and deporting people who are found to be in the country undocumented.
Well, that's the question, and I don't think there's a clear answer on it just yet. ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is a subset of Department of Homeland Security, they don't release data that really explains exactly what these crimes are. They release categories of crime. It can include anything from failing to complete a stop at an intersection to domestic violence or drug possession. And so there's a wide range of potential crimes that people are getting picked up and deported for. Despite that, again, the initial goal of this program was dangerous criminals, defined as a aggravated felony or a violent crime or repeat crimes, and that is what's happening in most of the country. In most of the country, people getting deported under the program have committed those crimes and convicted of them, but for whatever reason, that's not the case in Maryland.
Hmm. And is there one section of the state, could you tell from looking at the records, where this is happening with greater frequency than in others?
Yeah, I have looked at the county data, and I think you'll see more in the sun on that in coming days. I think it's not necessarily what you'd expect. Frederick County is very high, as you would expect. It's a county that's been very aggressive on illegal immigration, and it is a pretty high county, but it's not alone. Anne Arundel County, Baltimore County, Prince George's County, they all have similar shares of non-criminals being deported, and frankly, because of the higher population, their numbers are much higher. So it's not just sort of the conservative Republican parts of the state that you might think would be more aggressive that are driving this. It's also a Democratic county like Prince George's County and more purple counties around the state that appear to be experiencing this.
Hmm. When you were doing the reporting for this story, John, and talking to different people, I guess, from both sides of the immigration reform question, you must have heard it argued that undocumented immigrants take a risk by being here illegally, and so what if they get deported? You know, there are many Americans who feel undocumented immigrants broke a law and should be sent home.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, my inbox is flooded with those points, and they're totally valid. These folks are here illegally, and they sort of knew that they were taking a risk when they crossed the border or overstayed a visa. It's a totally legitimate point. I think it's a little bit of a separate argument. I think what I'm interested in is the fact that if you believe the Obama administration when they say that, hey, we can't deport everybody because the system just can't handle that, And if you further believe that, well, if we have to prioritize who we're going to deport, then let's prioritize people who not only came into the country illegally, but who are causing all kinds of problems once they get here, or terrorizing communities, or involved in serious crimes. If you sort of believe that that is where the focus should be, then, again, I think there's questions to be asked about why in Maryland there's such a high share of non-criminals being scooped up under this program.
And just let's go back to Governor O'Malley for a moment and the reaction to your story. What exactly did he say about this? Did he feel Homeland Security is abusing this program?
You know, it's an interesting letter. It was more sharply worded than I expected. I think he said in the letter he had concerns about this. He noted that the feds have always sold this program as something targeted at dangerous criminals, and he had questions about whether that was actually what's happening. Interestingly, the state had data in their letter that I had not seen, which makes me think that maybe they've looked into this on their own or were aware of it on their own. And what he basically said was, look, Obama administration, in the next couple of weeks, I'd like some answers on this. I'd like some sort of an explanation for what's happening. And I'd like to see some data that has not been publicly available that might explain what's going on. And he also pointed to a bill that's pending in the General Assembly in Annapolis that advocates feel like could address the situation, or at least mitigate the situation, and that would deal with the circumstances under which local jails can hold these people beyond when they would ordinarily be eligible for release.
John Fritzy covers Capitol Hill and the federal government for The Sun. You can find the story that we're talking about, actually a couple stories now, about secure communities on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, linking you to BaltimoreSun.com. John, thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
One man who fully supports secure communities is the Frederick County Sheriff, Chuck Jenkins. Since 2008, Sheriff Jenkins has partnered with the Department of Homeland Security and ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to detain illegal immigrants at the Frederick County Detention Center. According to the Frederick News Post, 16 correctional officers and 10 deputies became deputized immigration agents to handle deportation proceedings at the jail. Sheriff Jenkins has started to face some pushback for his department's aggressive approach to immigrants in the county, and he's facing some opponents for re-election. Cliff Cumber is the editorial page editor of the News Post, and he joins us again from Frederick today. Welcome back to Midday, Cliff.
It's wonderful to be here, Dan. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Just how extensive has Frederick's participation in secure communities been?
Well, it has been extensive. The program, which we know here as 287G, most familiarly, started in 2008, and it has been, as you know, pursued very aggressively by Sheriff Jenkins since that time. It certainly has earned him a reputation, certainly amongst those who support illegal immigrants and advocacy for them. And the comparison has been made to Joe Arpaio out of Maricopa County as sort of they've been characterized as very akin to each other. Hmm. So it has been an extensive program here.
Now, given the reporting of John Fritzy, we just heard us talking to John about this. I just wonder, has Frederick County deported people who were serious criminals? Have they also caught in the net people who were originally picked up for misdemeanors, not even that, for traffic violations?
Oh, yes, clearly. If you look at the Sheriff's Office 2012 annual report, you'll see that of about 1,136 detainers that were lodged, and as John mentioned in the previous interview, this is when the individual is arrested and information is forwarded to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the ICE program, and they determined if the individual should be held pending proceedings in immigration court. Of those detainers that were lodged, over 1,000, about 1,030, were arrested for misdemeanor offenses. That leaves about 108, that's about 9.5%, who were arrested for felony offenses.
Hmm. It raises the same question, doesn't it? The original intent of the program was to make sure violent criminals weren't in the country or people involved in drug running. And here we are sending people home who, yeah, albeit are in the country undocumented, but did nothing more than, park in the wrong place or maybe...
traffic stops and things like that, yeah. Yes, that's clear. As John had that question about the discrepancy between these arrests and the intentions of the program run federally, we've editorialized on that in the past as well. We've seen that similar kind of discrepancy is that people like Arpaio and early on in the 287G program, that very much the sheriffs themselves drove the policies of the program, how aggressive they were going to be themselves.
So who's running against Sheriff Jenkins? Sheriff Jenkins, I might add, is a Republican. Who's running against him, and do any of them have enough support out there to mount a serious challenge?
Well, that's a good question. Sheriff Jenkins, as you know, Frederick County tends to be a little conservative, and Sheriff Jenkins has a tremendous amount of support. In fact, a large amount of that support is driven by his opposition to what he calls making Frederick County not a sanctuary county for illegal immigrants. He has in the primary Kevin Grubb, who is a former assistant chief of the Frederick Police Department, the city here in Frederick County, the only Democrat in the race right now is a gentleman named Carl Bickle. He was a uniformed patrol officer, detective with the Metropolitan Police Department, and he also has worked for the sheriff's office as second in command, and currently he's a policy and analyst with the Department of Justice. And he ran 4 years ago as a writing candidate, and he's now the Democrat in the race.
I mean, there have been some controversies in Frederick County involving deputy sheriffs aside from the 287G, but I wonder, are they going to use 287G against Jenkins, or is it a popular program in Frederick County? Do you have a feel for that, Cliff?
It is a popular program here, it's one that's fully supported by the Board of County Commissioners, who have actively supported Sheriff Jenkins in his pursuit of deportation of undocumented workers. So I'll be leery to see if there's any leverage there, if there's any points of weakness in that particular aspect of the campaign.
Cliff Cumber is editorial page editor for the Frederick News Post. Cliff, thanks for being with us again.
Great to be here. Thanks, Dan.
Contractor Willard Hackeman left his imprint all over Baltimore. His Whiting Turner Company built the M&T Bank Stadium where the Ravens play, Harbor Place, the National Aquarium, the Meyerhoff Symphony Hall, the new University of Baltimore Law School, and countless other buildings in Maryland and around the country. Willard Hackeman built the company into a contracting giant with $5 billion in annual billings. When he died at 95 this week, he left on the drawing board ambitious plans for a new downtown arena for the city, something he was willing to build with his own millions. We'll talk about the Hackerman legacy now with WYPR news analyst Fraser Smith and with Ryan Sharrow of the Baltimore Business Journal. Welcome to Ryan, and welcome to Fraser.
Good to be with you, Dan.
Hey, Dan, how you doing?
Good, Ryan. Thanks for joining us. Fraser.
Sure.
I'm going to start with Fraser on this. Willard Hackerman, one of those larger-than-life people who kept a very low profile, not a person who revealed much about himself or what he was thinking to the press. And you know that, Fraser, from years spent covering, along with me, William Donald Schaefer, the mayor, then governor, who led many of the efforts to fund these big projects that Hackerman's company won contracts to undertake. But he was a private guy. Did you have opportunities to interview him?
Only one. Mm-hmm. I wrote a book about William Donald Schaefer, and he agreed to talk to me for that project. I spent an hour with him in his office. I've seen him around, you know.
Same here.
You know, he sponsored a Martin Luther King memorial 1 year, and I saw him in the Symphony Hall, and I said, "I understand you had a lot to do with this. Would you talk to me about it?" And he said, "No." And that was it. And that was really almost always his response on things like this.
That's a reference to his philanthropy, which was quite extensive. But again, not a lot of press on that.
Well, he just didn't want it. He thought that what he was doing spoke for himself and for his company. And the company was doing really well. And I told him, I walked with him back to his office when I was out there. And there were photographs of all these massive projects that he did. And I said, you know, nobody knows about this. They just know Whiting Turner is big, but they just don't know how what reach you have. And so, you know, why don't you open up a little bit? He said, I don't see what that would do for me. And that was the end of that conversation.
Wow.
But, you know, at the—
just to a point that you made there, I don't think Baltimoreans fully appreciated how big a company that was, and I, including me.
No, I think that's
right. $5 billion in annual billings of late. 33 regional offices and projects going on all over the place.
You know, Dan, I went to the service for him at Beth Tefillah this week. And, you know, here's a 95-year-old man. There were 500 people in the audience. I mean, when you get to be 95, a lot of people that you knew in your life
gone, yeah.
are not here anymore. Yeah. So, you know, the imprint was there. And you know, the story that you mentioned to me earlier, where the rabbi went to see him, Rabbi Wolberg went to see him.
Well, I heard your commentary on this, but tell our listeners this story.
Well, he went to see Hackerman in the hospital and leaned over his bed and said, it's Rabbi Wolberg. Do you have enough strength to sign another check?
Everybody laughed.
Everybody laughed. Yeah. And because, you know, in a certain part of the community, of course, in the Jewish neighborhoods of the city, people knew Hackerman quite well.
Mm-hmm. Big-time philanthropist in Baltimore. I want to return now to Ryan Sharrow at the Baltimore Business Journal. About 3 years ago, Ryan, we heard about these plans that Willard Hackerman pushed for a new arena for downtown Baltimore, and he was willing to put a lot of his own money into it. So first, I want you to tell our listeners about that plan, what it entailed. And then I'd like to know what its status is, and what are people saying now about it, now that Mr. Hackerman has died?
Yeah, so the plan was introduced, as you've said, about 3 years ago. It calls for building a new arena and hotel at the intersection of Conway and Charles Streets. It's about right in the middle of Camden Yards in the Inner Harbor, about two blocks away from each. And that project alone would be about $400 million, I believe, closer to five, and that would also include an expanded convention center. This sits right to the rear of the current convention center. And, you know, from what I understand, it was Hackerman's idea. He had this vision. He owns that site. There's currently a Sheridan Inner Harbor Hotel there. He owns that building. And he was willing to put up, according to the Greater Baltimore Committee, which is sort of the mouthpiece for this project, because as you guys mentioned, he doesn't like to say a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So the GVC has been spearheading the effort, and they said he was willing to put up about $200 million for the hotel portion. And, you know, the rest would have to be privately financed. Of course, there would probably be some public funding as well. And it's been a little bit quiet as of late. You haven't heard much. The GBC said last year that about 35% of that private financing had been identified. So that still leaves a pretty big gap when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, in terms of the passing of Mr. Hackerman, it certainly raises the question of, well, was he planning to still leave this money for that project? That's something that nobody really knows as of now. At least we don't know publicly. Nobody really wanted to sort of address that matter this week for the right reasons. He just passed. It wouldn't be quite right to bring that up. So I do know that city officials seem to like that site as well. It's obviously a good location. It would connect the convention center with a new arena. The current arena, obviously, the Baltimore Arena, is 52 years old. A replacement is needed. It still does well financially, but it's just outdated. So now sort of that lingering question is, will this project move forward? Things have been quiet for some time. You have to imagine it's because of the funding issue.
Just one question about that project, Ryan. So would it involve tearing down the Sheraton and building the arena on that site? So the arena would be connected to the convention center and be part of the convention business.
That's correct, and that's sort of a strategy some other cities have taken. It allows for bigger conventions. You know, if you're talking about a new 18,500-seat arena attached to the convention center, you can obviously do a lot more things. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, Baltimore undertook a bigger convention center several years back, but it's already smaller when compared to other cities. I know Philadelphia is bigger, Washington, D.C. is bigger, so it's something city officials would obviously jump at an opportunity to expand the convention center as well, but that's not going to be cheap.
Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's Ryan Sharrow from the BBJ, the Baltimore Business Journal. One last thing, since you wrote the book on William Donald Schaefer, Willard Heckerman and he were good friends, and people used to say, well, there's something going on between those two over contracts. How could Willard Heckerman keep getting all these contracts? That relationship is far too cozy. You know, people assume that. What would you say about their relationship?
Well, people are apt to make those kinds of judgments based on nothing. And there certainly was never any criminal action taken against either one of them in regard to that. It's possible that Heckerman got the work because his work was really good. I mean,
it's
you
totally,
know, amazing,
it's
amazingly.
Clear.
Yes,
it's
right.
Clear, yeah.
Yeah, sure, you wanted the best job and you want it done efficiently. And his record was good, and so he kept doing well. You know, Dan, I was thinking on that day, actually, that they unveiled a statue of Schaefer in the Inner Harbor, looking around thinking to myself, this could be a statue of both of these guys.
Yeah.
Because one of them had actually, I mean, they had done it together, really. It's quite a story, really, when you think about
the Inner Harbor, what it was 40 years ago.
You know, and the other thing I think is that what happens to the Civic Center plans is one thing, but apparently Heckerman, and nobody knows what the totals are, but he made lots of gifts to nonprofits all over the city. I mean, the one thing that I heard this week was he made a visit to the Bryn Mawr School, and he said, if there are kids here who would be interested in women, it's a
girls,
it's a
interested
girl school
in engineering.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
And he gave them some money for that.
Yes, he did. He set up the scholarship.
Right. Fraser, thanks for being here.
Sure.
Fraser Smith, the WYPR senior news analyst and also columnist with the Daily Record. The Midday Weekly Review will continue in a minute. It's Valentine's Day, of course, Valentine's weekend, you might say. Paula Gallagher of the Baltimore County Library offers some reading suggestions, what she calls unconventional love stories, not your storybook romances. And if you're interested in a concert, we'll tell you about one this weekend in Westminster with the funk soul sounds of Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds. Coming up in the second hour of today's show, after the NPR News at 1, it's the return of Midday Eats, our monthly food hour with Henry Hong of the Waterfront Kitchen in Fells Point and Johnny Shields of Gertrude's in the Baltimore Museum of Art. This month, John and Henry take the Midday Chef's Challenge, and we talk about the food of love. It's Valentine's Day, Valentine's weekend, and we'll hear what Henry and John suggest for those looking to prepare a romantic meal. And we'd also like to hear from listeners about that. If you have a memorable romantic meal to share with us, please do so in the hour ahead. In this hour, we have a couple of ideas for your weekend. First, we asked Paula Gallagher to join us again, a librarian at the Pikesville branch of the Baltimore County Public Library who blogs about books as Paula G. She has some suggestions for what she calls unconventional love stories, not your storybook romances. This sounds intriguing to us. Hello, Paula. How are you?
Hi, Dan. I'm great. Thanks.
So what do you have in mind when it comes to this unconventional love stories, not your storybook romance?
Well, the books I want to talk about are the books that you'll find at the library in places other than the romance section. When we hear the word romance, I think people often think of those small paperbacks, those bodice rippers with the woman who's got, you know, a lot of cleavage and maybe that Regency-style dress, and the men who are very muscular and about to take them. And those are not the romances I want to talk about today. And I also think that many people, when they hear romance, they think of, oh, this is books for women, this is chick lit.
Right.
And so the books that I want to share are books that are not necessarily just for women. These are books that the guys can read, too.
Okay.
And so I want to get started with a little anecdote and talk about the book The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger. This book's been around a while. It came out in 2003. And it's the story of a man who is chronologically displaced. He travels through time not of his own will. It's just something that happens automatically. It happens unplanned. Suddenly, it does not take him to some famous time, place, or to some, you know, particular moment in history. He just goes throughout his life timeline in a scattered way. And he meets this young woman by the name of Claire, and he actually meets her for the first time when she's 6 years old, which sounds a little strange, maybe a little creepy. But the author manages to create this tremendous romance that defies that time and place as he meets her at different times and stages in her life. And this book has been beloved by many people. It was made into a not-so-great movie, but I bring this up in terms of men and reading because I have a friend named Josh, and he's a 20-something, and he told me that that was his favorite book. And I was very surprised because I usually you think of it as a women's book. And so I asked him how he had even come to read it, let alone have it as his favorite book. And he told me that he'd been dating a lot, and he'd been, you know, looking at online profiles, and it seemed like, as he said, all the chicks said that was their favorite book. And so he decided that he needed to know what was happening in that book. And he read it. And he
a good way to start a conversation.
Book.
I get you. All right. So The Time Traveler's Wife. You have another one for us, Paula?
Yes. I'd like to. There's a nonfiction book called The Journal of Best Practices. And the subtitle is A Memoir of Marriage, Asperger's Syndrome, and One Man's Quest to Be a Better Husband by David Finch.
Wow.
And, yeah, that's a lot. So this is a guy, he's reached the age of 30, and he knows he's very idiosyncratic. He's got a lot of quirks. But, you know, he's been married for 5 years to the love of his life, Kirsten. And he can sense that things are just not going well, but he doesn't know where to put his finger on it. And he comes home from work one day, and his wife has left him a note, and she says, you know, I've got some pizza waiting for you down in the basement. Why don't you get comfortable? Come on down. Join me down there. And so he comes down, excited, he's going to have some pizza, and she says, I want to ask you some questions, and she's on the computer, and she says, so, you know, relax and just answer, and so she begins this questionnaire, and as he's listening and he's answering the questions, he's very excited because he feels like, wow, this is all about me. Where did she find this quiz? Did she write a quiz that would be all about me? And it turns out that she has also been worry about their marriage and kind of fed up, and somehow she gets the idea that maybe it's something more than him just acting like a guy, and she gives him a quiz that diagnoses him with Asperger's syndrome.
The title of this book again is The Journal of
Best Practices.
Best Practices. Okay.
Yeah.
Definitely unconventional.
You know, go ahead.
I was going to say definitely unconventional choices, Paula. Before we let you go, and thank you for those. But before we let you go, I was just curious about what's in demand this winter at the Pikesville branch. Could you give us quickly the maybe top five fiction, top five nonfiction? I'm real curious about that.
Sure. We pretty much mirror the New York Times bestseller list. Laura Lippman's new After I'm Gone, which has just come out. And these are all going to be books that have wait lists. Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch, which I talked about last time I was on.
Mm-hmm.
The Husband's Secret by Laura Moriarty. Still Life with Breadcrumbs by Anna Quindlen. And The Invention of Wings by Sue Monk Kidd. One last one in fiction that's in demand, but you may find in the branch, is John Grisham's Sycamore Row.
And on the nonfiction side?
People are very interested in The Monuments Men, which is an excellent book made into a not-so-excellent movie. Also the collection of essays by Charles Krauthammer, Things That Matter. Robert Gates' memoir, Duty. The Malcolm Gladwell, David and Goliath. And finally, George Washington's Secret Six by Brian Kilmeade and Don Yeager.
Paula, have a wonderful Valentine's Day. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Dan.
It's Paula Gallagher. You can find a link to Paula's blog about books on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. That's the funk soul sound of a band from Brooklyn, New York called Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds. I like this sound.
What time did you get up? Work tonight, baby. I think
that's Sister Sparrow. They performed this weekend at the Snail Pie Lounge. Where's the Snail Pie Lounge? Well, there's a little story in that question, so we asked the lounge's founder, Steve Webster, to explain. Steve, welcome to Midday. Nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Dan.
The Snail Pie story, for listeners in brief, we did this a couple of months ago, but I wanted to go over it with you again. You started in a barn in Pennsylvania, is that right?
That's correct.
How long ago was that?
About 10 years ago. I was looking for an out-of-print album from one of my favorite folk musicians, Spider John Kerner. Stumbled upon his website and actually contacted his management, and he came down for our first show. He's a favorite of Garrison Keillor, who's...
Yeah. Wait, was this a barn on your property?
Yes.
Where in Pennsylvania was it?
That's in Glenville, Pennsylvania, very southern York County.
So for 10 years, you staged concerts there?
Yeah, and just kept... I used Spider's name to get Guy Davis. We've had Corey Harris, Alvin Hart, Junior Brown, Leon Russell... Rock and roll royalty.
Leon Russell got to the Snail Pie Lounge.
I took Leon Russell to lunch, or actually he took me to lunch.
Where'd the name come from, Snail Pie Lounge?
I was driving up the road one day, and I found all these neon box letters on the side of the road, and I took them home, and we laid them out, and we thought, what can we spell with this? And it was actually a Pearl Vision sign, but...
You're kidding.
We decide Snail Pie was sort of a vague blues reference.
So what happened to the barn? It sounds like a great venue.
It is. Very intimate. It's family-oriented, BYOB. The township sort of caught wind of us at some point, and they were concerned about a few safety features. So we're sort of re-looking at that and trying to adjust things, you know, according to what they'd like us to do.
Well, so you've had to move. So you may come back to the barn? Is that what you
said? Yes. Oh, okay. With some, because I mean, they have said we have a right to have a house concert, and so we're looking into that. But in the meantime, we found a little theater in Westminster, the Carroll Arts Center, and I went to see the Weber Brothers, who play with Ronnie Hawkins now, who where the band started. And it had sort of the same intimate feel. You know, nothing is quite like the Snail Pie Lounge, but it had an intimate feel. And
Now that in the barn in Glenville, before you had to move out, like how many people would you get there? If you had a full house, what would it be?
We could hold about 85.
Huh. And you staged these how often over the years?
We got up to about 12 shows. We generally went from April to... sometimes as late as November.
Okay.
Tried to do one or no more than two a month.
All right. For the time being, though, you moved to the Carroll Arts Center in Westminster.
Yes.
Can we hear a little bit more of that band? Because I want Steve to talk about this young funk soul out of Brooklyn, New York. They got some brass in this band, right?
Oh, three-piece brass. Big-time horn players. Arlie Kinchelow is the lead singer and songwriter. Her brother is the harmonica player, and her cousin is the drummer. And they played a two-night show at the lounge. They're my grandson's favorite band because they were such nice guys. They carried him around, read him stories. It was really a great weekend we had with them.
So you had them in the barn. What would you say the style of music you've had over the years? Blues?
Well, we started with blues. We've had Junior Brown,
best
chicken picker out there. We've had Tony Trischka, one of the great bluegrass banjo players. We have an up-and-coming band called Jesse Caroline and the Hot Mess. They do like 1920s jazz and blues music. Just anything that's we really like to stress kind of instrumental dexterity. We like hot players.
And the hope is that you can return to the barn someday. For now, the Snail Pie Lounge is at the Carroll Arts Center. So this weekend, it's Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds. They're performing there. What time is that? Saturday night,
Steve? It'll be doors at 7:30, show at 8. Yingling, $2.
Okay.
Custom beers for $4. So it's a good Valentine's night out.
Well, great. I'm glad you found a new venue for the bands. And if you get back to the barn someday, make sure you let us know about that, okay?
I'll do that.
Yeah, that's great. All right. More information, folks, at the Snail Pie Lounge. Not the Snail Pie. Just snailpielounge.com. It's sort of hard to forget that. And the concert is at the Carroll Arts Center, 91 West Main Street in Westminster.
And bring the kids. It's very kid-friendly. We're family-oriented.
Okay. Steve, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks
for
trekking in from Glenville, Pennsylvania to be on our show. We're going to take a break here, as we always do at the end of our first hour. We have lunch today provided by Joe Squared. Joe Squared is family-owned and offers coal-fired pizza and 17 varieties of risotto. Joe Squared is located at the Inner Harbor Power Plant Live and Station North. Thanks to Joe Squared for the pizza for our guests. And go to the Dan Roddick's Facebook page. You can find a link to Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds, their website, and Snail Pie Lounge, and also information about what else is going on at the Carroll Arts Center in Westminster. Stay tuned for the news coming up, and then we have Hong and Shields, Midday Eats returns here for the first time after a couple of months. Henry and John are in the house. We'll see you soon.